Good morning, and thanks for downloading and listening. You've queued up an audio edition of Offbeat Oregon Du Jour, a daily RSS podcast feed brought to you by the Offbeat Oregon History weekly newspaper column. Each day we bring you a new story from our archives, stories of heroes and rascals, of shipwrecks and lost treasure, of shanghaied sailors and skid road bordellos and pirates and robbers and unsolved mysteries and just all kinds of great stuff. To get these delivered regularly every day, direct your podcatcher to ofor.us/p. These podcasts are proudly simple. No bumper music, no audio assets, nothing but me reading the columns to you. And occasionally throwing in a comment or two when I just can't help myself. My goal is to make it possible for you to read the columns without actually reading the columns. In your car, for instance. So, also, I must tell you that if these podcasts were a movie, they would be rated PG. Like the Offbeat Oregon History newspaper column, most people will find them suitable for family listening. Today's column was first published on December 5th, 2010. Its headline is Temperance Crusaders Showed Saloon Keeper a Real Bar Fight. Its overview: owner of Webfoot Saloon squared off with dozens of hymn-singing upper-crust Victorian ladies on a temperance crusade in 1874. Guess who won? Here's the article. In the spring of 1874, something closely resembling a riot took place on the streets of downtown Portland. And as you may have guessed, alcohol was involved. But it's probably not what you think. In 1874, the temperance movement was sweeping the nation. Saloon keepers, brewers, distillers, and other traffickers in demon rum were getting a little nervous about it. It was spearheaded by activists who were invulnerable to attack, against whom every mudslinging attempt redounded against the would-be mudslinger. Upper-crust Victorian ladies. Praying. Singing hymns. In Portland, the temperance movement found a champion in the Portland Daily Bulletin, the reform movement's answer to the Oregonian in that age of multiple daily newspapers in tiny frontier cities. Although the Oregonian was quite sympathetic to the temperance movement as well. Although, I have to say, I'm pretty sure that the editors of both newspapers partook fairly liberally in the bottle. The ladies' crusade against, quote, that mighty and terrible ruler, Old King Alcohol, as the bulletin phrased it, started with the formation of a local temperance society in the image of similar outfits back east. Primarily, this was composed of ladies who were either tired of their husbands drinking all the time or who found the spectacle of a boozy Friday night near the waterfront unseemly. They started out by praying and singing hymns for extended periods of time in their churches. This didn't prove particularly effective, as the pub-crawling set wasn't seen much in churches, at least not until Saturday night melted into Sunday morning, by which time they would probably deny everything. So, the ladies decided to go forth and beard the lion in his den. First, they split their cohort of a dozen or so ladies up into pairs like Mormon missionaries and went out to make some house calls to as many local watering holes as possible. At the end of the day, the saloon keepers were delighted. The presence of two full-blown upper-crust Victorian ladies praying, singing, and pleading for temperance in the tavern stimulated business in a rather astonishing way. It was like having a circus in the pub. Not surprisingly, the bulletin reports that, in most instances, the ladies were treated in a respectful manner, although it goes on to complain that we heard of one case where they were shamefully abused by the proprietress of a low doggery on 2nd Street. Low doggery. I just love that. By the way, 2nd Street seems to have been where all of the really nasty pubs were at this time. Respectful or no, the ladies knew they were being made fun of. the little bands had met with but meager success, and discouragement presented itself at every hand, the bulletin noted glumly. Their pledges of abstinence from alcohol received but few signatures, most of which were fictitious names. Demoralized, they returned to their churches. Amid the rejoicing, though, some of the saloon keepers were worried, and well they should have been. The next day, March 25th, 1874, the ladies tried something new. All 13 of them descended en masse on Thomas Shardle's saloon, the Mount Hood, on First Street. At first it seemed like a repeat of the previous day's disaster. Their hymns and prayers were made sport of, and the liquor business was never better than it was when they were present. According to the bulletin, many jovial bar patrons jokingly drank toasts to the success of their crusade, gestures of encouragement which a few dozen years later they might have had cause to regret. Even so, it was immediately clear that the new strategy was a big improvement. The ladies may not have had instant success, but they did have each other to lean on, and as the public learned what was going on, their numbers swelled. Moreover, once the novelty of carol-singing ladies hogging all the bar stools wore off, business stopped surging when they came to a saloon, and the saloon keeper's welcome got a lot less cordial. By early April, there were dozens of them, and their arrival at a tavern meant not a lucrative afternoon, but the effective closure of the bar for as long as they chose to stay. The hymn was probably their most effective weapon. It's hard to guzzle gin when "Nearer, my God, to thee" is roaring in one's ears with the strength of three or four dozen zealous voices, especially if one or more of those voices belongs to a family friend. However, there were lots of bars downtown, and most of them were not infested at any given time with temperance crusaders. Those who wanted to drink and do so in peace could do so pretty much anywhere else, and they did. Most barkeepers gritted their teeth and sucked it up, trying, to use a metaphor 50 years before its time, to stay off the ladies' radar. But one, Walter Moffat, owner of the notorious Webfoot Saloon, quickly identified himself as an exception. He refused to let the ladies into his bar, so they ranged on the sidewalk outside and sang as if they were bringing down the walls of Jericho. Moffat responded by hiring people to beat big Chinese gongs to drown them out. One of these, the bulletin reports, was diligently beating his gong right next to a singing lady's head on April 2nd when his victim suddenly snatched it from him and, quote, retained possession of it. As the weeks went by, the feud with the Webfoot worsened. Lighted strings of firecrackers were thrown out the windows at the ladies, which legally, given the flammability of the clothing of the day, probably constituted reckless endangering. Later, the bartender chose a particularly convenient time to hose off the outside of his establishment. The ladies sang on, dripping wet in expensive garments that were probably ruined. The tavern's hired gong beater, the bulletin sniffs, made himself particularly obnoxious to every citizen who had the least respect for decency. Finally, Moffat swore out a warrant for their arrest on a charge of disorderly conduct. Apparently, the bulletin scoffed, singing and praying in a public street was disorderly behavior. Who knew? The first time it came up, the judge agreed with the bulletin's analysis of that situation and threw the case out. But when the ladies were arrested again a day or two later, this time on a disturbing the peace rap, a trial was actually scheduled. This time, the legal theory was different. The ladies hadn't disturbed the peace personally. The crowd of rowdies who had come to watch them square off with the Webfoot head, and in fact, a giant knockdown dragout had broken out when that crowd of rowdies, one particular individual objected strenuously to one of the Webfoot saloon employees' decision to start cursing at the ladies and punched him between the eyes. and the fighting became general, and really it was pretty much a riot. So that was the legal theory. Without the ladies, there would have been no riot, so the ladies were being charged with having incited one. The jury, reluctantly, found them guilty. They were all sentenced to pay a fine of $5 each or spend the night in jail. To the surprise of almost everyone in court, the ladies insisted on the jail option and would not be talked out of it. Once incarcerated, the ladies made the joint ring with songs of praise, hymns, and prayers for the souls of the city's drinking men. They also entertained visitors until fairly late into the evening. It must have gotten on the sheriff's nerves, because long before midnight, the sheriff stormed into the jail and ordered them off the premises. Kicked them out of jail quite a bit early, inconveniently early. And that was the end of that. Well, the temperance fight continued until Congress voted the Volstead Act into effect over Woodrow Wilson's veto in 1919, kicking off the Great American Experiment in Prohibition. Of course, in Oregon, we had Prohibition before that, but it wasn't really enforced too much. The situation with the Webfoot Saloon kind of faded away after an election came along and some fairly inappropriate campaign material was distributed with the temperance workers' names on it. Many cities had witnessed scenes like Portland's showdown at the Webfoot by the time Prohibition went into effect, but very few could boast of any quite that colorful. And that's it for today. You just heard Temperance Crusaders Showed Saloon Keeper a Real Bar Fight by Finn J.D. John. That would be me. First published on December 5th, 2010. If you'd like to see the art for this story, including a delightful piece of sheet music titled Girls Wait for a Temperance Man, which you can download a PDF of, and if you're handy with a piano, you can torture your relatives with it at your very next family gathering. But as I was saying, if you'd like to print out a copy for your friends or see that art, look online at www.offbeatoregon.com. You'll find the articles very easy to look up. They're listed in order of the date they were first published, so just look for the December 2010 articles and you will spot it immediately. That covers us until tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll be uploading a story on America's first rest area with marble walls and mahogany doors. The legendary Crown Point Vista House, looking out over the Columbia Gorge Highway, a highway built when road building was an art more than a science, almost. So until then, have a great day. Hope to catch you then.